Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Since maybe about the mid-90s, there has been some very significant growth in the number of novels written primarily by and for women. And often these are novels that feature characters, they're women in their, say, 20s to 30s who live in urban settings, who, among other things, are struggling with trying to balance the competing demands of career and personal life and trying to have a satisfying time at both. And this is a sector of publishing that has been often, I think, derisively called chick lit. Many people have dismissed it as being something like the literary equivalent of a Twinkie. Junk food, literary junk food. And I think that though others would say, including our guest here this morning, others would say, well, that's being that's painting with an overly broad brush. And then, in fact, within this area of writing, there may be books that are not very good, but then there may be also books that are quite well written and quite can be satisfying to read and perhaps tell you something about women's experience today. And, in fact, I think a lot of people would argue that the kinds of books that we're talking about maybe deserve a place on the shelf right alongside writers like Jane Austen that we revere, that maybe there's not all that much difference between what Jane Austen was writing about and what these writers here we're talking about are writing about. Our guest is Iris Barron. She's an instructor in the Department of English at the University of Illinois. She teaches a course on chick lit here at the university. And she, a few months back, she was here. We were doing one of our book shows, those shows where we invite people on the program, and we just talk about books. And we asked her on, and we started talking about the subject, and I felt that we didn't really get a very good chance to dip into it, and I thought it would be interesting to have her come back and talk some more with us about chick lit and all other kinds of women's literature. And she said, sure, she would do that. So we're pleased to have her here with us this morning. The questions are welcome. We'd invite anybody into the conversation that wants to join in, share their thoughts, ask questions. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much.
I'm glad to be on the show this morning.
Well, we're prompted to ask a kind of a question like, when did we start talking about this, and when did it start? And we could always get back to this point that says, well, maybe it started at Jane Austen, but in the way we talk about it now, chick lit, when exactly did this start?
Okay, well, there was a big Austen revival in the late 80s and the early 1990s. To some extent, in part, I think fostered by the BBC and public television stations here, sure, as well. So I'll give you guys a little kudos for that.
Thank you.
And I think it really appealed to readers. Austen appealed to readers for the first time in a very long time, because I think it really paralleled some of the issues that were going on in our culture. All of Austen's novels are comedies of manners. And I think the fact that Seinfeld was very popular on television made a difference on that as well, because Seinfeld created the same, I think, kind of a scripting that Austen does in her novels. And, you know, TV shows that were about nothing and literature that was essentially about nothing, and really was located around the issue of comic interchange between individuals and kind of social critique. So I think that's really what gave it the impetus to start. And as people became more interested in Austen's novels and they were put on the silver screen a lot more, I think the idea of doing postmodern versions and knockoffs of the novel started appealing to some writers and directors. And Clueless, to me, is really the first chick lit piece. And I know there are other critics who will argue with me and say it's Bridget Jones's Diary. Mm-hmm. But I think Clueless really set the mark for it. You know, it's a modernist version of Emma. And it was incredibly popular and funny and dealt with a kind of epistolary construct. You know, the diary format and the ditzy heroine who sort of comes to age during the course of the piece. And I think it was so widely enjoyed that it really kind of fostered a new appreciation of that kind of literature.
Yeah. I think this is the first time I'd ever heard someone draw comparisons between Jane Austen and Seinfeld. That's interesting. People, I think, when they think about chick lit, probably unless they've actually done some exploration or they actually follow fiction and so forth, they will indeed think about probably Bridget Jones as being that's when it seems to have appeared on the map. But Helen Fielding wasn't really the first writer to write that kind of book.
No, she actually. You really begin to see pieces like this emanating and percolating around British fiction in the 1950s with Barbara Pym. And actually, I teach a class now on women's fiction from Jane Austen to Helen Fielding, and I include Barbara Pym's Excellent Women. And it's got the same kind of character setup. There's a 30-something woman, Mildred Lathbury, and she lives in London. And she's dowdy, and she's constantly aggravated over her lack of a social situation, and it's a precursor. It's certainly different. It has a very different kind of a view of single status than a piece like Bridget Jones's Diary does. And you know, after that, I think pieces that came out in the late 70s and the early 80s, like Baby Boom, I think really is a precursor, and a piece like Private Benjamin, which I think was really important as well. And they kind of go into the formula because people would like everyone to believe that one day Helen Fielding woke up and she had this aha, you know, kind of an experience. And suddenly she just sat down, you know, and tripped her toes over to the computer and wrote, you know, Bridget Jones's Diary. And that's not the case, actually. There were a lot of precursors of this kind of lit before that.
Is there something, though, about that particular book that helped to make it so popular, or was it just that it was the right book at the right time?
I think, yeah, it was the right book at the right time. Well, there are a few things. First of all, I think Austen was really popular in the mid-1990s, Pride and Prejudice particularly. And this came out right around the time of that BBC production with Colin Firth of Pride and Prejudice that everybody is so enamored of. And so I think there was a sense of unity between the pieces, and it was in the public consciousness. And also, I think this is a period of time, too, as we're moving toward the end of the millennium, where women are living on their own. And we've had about, you know, 30 years by that point of, I think, hardcore feminism. And one of the things that I think started happening to women in the 1990s who were in their late 20s and early 30s is that they thought that they were going to have it all. They would have a career, they would change, you know, these overarching social structures about gender politics, they would have a perfect husband, they would have a perfect house, and they would start a family with their 2.5 children. And it didn't quite work out that way, and I think there was a lot of bitterness about it, and I think it came as a surprise to a lot of women that they were considered undesirable. Hmm. And I think to some extent that's how chick lit got started.
So do you think it must be because it was very popular and these writers and these books have sold a lot of books, the case that women were reading it not simply because just they found it light entertainment, but that they were reading it in part because they felt that that somehow reflected their experience. They were seeing, in some way, they were looking at those characters and they were sort of saying, well, you know, I can identify with that character. That's me.
Yeah. There's a lot of self-help lit that came out in the early 90s, too, I think, that kind of moved toward a fostering of these kinds of novels as well. So pieces like The Rules, which sold millions of copies, it's unbelievable to me. And I agree with that. I think the genre is incredibly successful because women find it mirroring their life experiences. And I remember, I'm not embarrassed to say, my husband, who's been on the show several times and does grammar, he actually bought me my copy of Bridget Jones's Diary. And he was reading, he says, you might want to have a look at this, because I was planning a course on feminist British literature, and it was like a gift from the gods. Wow. It just completely rounded the course out perfectly, because I was starting with Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
And so I have to thank my husband for introducing me to the chick lit genre.
Famous wag, Dennis Barron, who's been here on the program before. We always have a lot of fun when he's here. You know, that's funny. Just for the other day, and I don't know why, I thought about The Rules. I remember when this book came out, it caused a huge stir. And there were all these young women now that were being referred to as rules girls.
Rules girls.
Because the thing about this book was, this was a nonfiction book, and it was the rules about how to relate to men.
Yeah, dating.
Rules about dating, what you were supposed to
and
do, what you weren't supposed to do.
And there's rules, too, about how to behave once you're married.
Whatever happened to that? It was
they're
huge.
Still
they
selling.
Sold a lot of people still
but,
buy
you know,
it?
They've been kind of overshadowed by new self-help books like He's Just Not That Into You, which came out, I think, about 2 years ago. And one of the writers of the Sex and the City show came up with this, a male writer, trying to sort of take over, I think, where the rules left off and telling women how to get a guy and how to sustain a relationship and how to tell mostly when it's failing.
Yeah. So see, I guess what I remember about The Rules is that it seems that there seemed to be this underlying assumption that men were just, you know what men want. Men only want one thing.
Yeah.
And you should be aware of that, and you should know how to. It was a really a little on the cynical side about how to control them and get what you want. And it was like, you know, there always got to be a quid pro quo. And before certain things happen, certain other things are supposed to happen.
Okay. Well, let me answer that in a very circuitous way. Okay, let's go back to Bridget Jones's Diary and Sex in the City. Okay, so you have this social assumption in the 1990s that women have sort of come of age. And I think this started earlier on. You know, you see it with the Virginia Slims commercials in the late 1960s. And this idea, you know, you've come a long way, baby. And this kind of transference from women's role in the past. And they would always show this late Victorian or early Edwardian woman. I don't know if you remember the cigarettes and the commercials.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, they'd be hiding in a shed and smoking. And their husband or their father would come out and pull them into the house and shame them. And then there'd be a cut to the present, and some very smarmy, sexy, and long-legged model would come walking out in a very short miniskirt, smoking a Virginia Slims cigarette, and the song would come up, "You've come a long way, baby, to get where you've got to. Today you've got your own cigarette, now, baby, you've come a long, long way." So the idea was that, you know, women's lib had completely fostered a sense of equality for women. Cigarettes actually in the 1920s were referred to as torches of freedom by some of the feminists because they felt that they were symbols of unification of women against male patriarchy, and then it created a sort of equitable environment for women to work in. So, you know, the irony of the Virginia Slims commercial is, yeah, okay, so women are smoking, so now their lung cancer rates go up. But they're still being paraded around like they're this sexual commodity, and the cigarettes are all flowery and pink, and they're being referred to as baby, which I find pretty objectionable as a feminist.
Well, what's interesting, not long ago I talked with the author of a book that was essentially a history of the cigarette industry in the United States. And it talked about the fact that at that particular time, the industry deliberately targeted women as a market and liked to foster this idea that smoking is a sign of
independence. Yes.
And I know, as you say, a lot of feminists would have looked at that advertising campaign, Virginia Slims, and would have said, oh, great, this is the benefit of feminism. Now we also have an equal opportunity to get cancer.
Right. Well, their lung cancer rates tripled and quadrupled after that. So unfortunately, they didn't make any more of a splash on the job market. And they did definitely target women. They had a group of people who actually, you know, focus groups who actually developed the cigarettes and the length of the cigarettes. And that, too, I think, spurred on with the advent of Twiggy and the supermodel. Some of the issues that Chick Lit brings up as well. Body image is a big issue in Chick Lit. And I think one of the reasons Bridget Jones's Diary was so popular was because she was weighing herself constantly and obsessively. And, you know, a lot of women found this to be somewhat of a caricature, but maybe not too much. And I actually brought a passage where, if it's okay.
Well, of course it's okay. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Where she's in the bathroom alone at night. Let me see what I did with this one now. Okay. Tuesday, March 7th, 130, 128, or 131 pounds. And there's three question marks after that. Alcohol units, zero. Cigarettes, 20. Calories, 1,500. Lottery tickets, 6. Very poor. Ugh, how can I have put on 3 pounds since the middle of the night? I was 130 when I went to bed, 128 at 4 a.m., and 131 when I got up. I can understand weight coming off. It could have evaporated or passed out of the body into the toilet. But how could it be put on? Could food react chemically with other food, double its density and volume, and solidify into even heavier and denser hard fat? I don't look fatter. I can fasten the button, though not unless the zipper on my 89 jeans. So maybe my whole body is getting smaller but denser. And the whole novel is just filled with scenes like this where she's got every diary entry is prefaced by a weighing in and a calorie count. And I think women could relate. I found it terribly funny because there have been days where I confess I've done similar things. And I just finished teaching it in one of my classes, and one of my kids was saying, I laugh so hard because I do exactly the same thing. So I think that is a sense of recognition is one of the things that made this literature very, very popular.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, Iris Barron. She's instructor in the Department of English at University of Illinois and teaches women's literature, various kinds of women's literature, everything from Jane Austen to Bridget Jones and beyond. And we're talking a little bit about that segment of fiction and perhaps why it appeals to too many women, and about the fact that, yes, people sometimes run it down, but let's say that there is good writing to be found there if that's what you're interested in reading.
There is, and I thought it was really interesting, too, that Bridget Jones, now we'll get callers calling, came out the same year as Harry Potter, which I also teach in my British fiction class. And the issue about the way women are depicted in both the pieces I find really fascinating. The fact that women are, you know, contrived as being very ditzy and very dysfunctional in a lot of Chick Lit novels, I found really, really interesting, because often these were women actually who were writing the novels particularly, and even the women who were characters in the novel had degrees from, you know, top-tier universities. Helen Fielding went to Oxford. And I found it really interesting, too, that at the same time that, you know, Sex and the City came on the scene and you see, you know, Carrie Bradshaw living her life in New York and feeling like she's coming up short constantly because she doesn't have potential husband material all the time. That there were, in, you know, the pop culture, pieces like Harry Potter came out that featured a boy who had magical powers and was, you know, going out and, you know, really kicking up a storm here and showing his intellectual and physical prowess. And then you get women who, you know, what's the big meta battle in, you know, Sex and the City? There's a guy who tries to rob Carrie of her Manolo Blahniks, and she's begging him, you know, please stop. And what's her heroic? She goes running down the street home after that. So I was kind of interested, too, in the dynamic between the two things. Why, you know, we're getting pieces like Harry Potter and a resurgence of interest in the Spider-Man trilogy. The third one just came out, where you see guys, you know, completely empowered in these Superman-esque roles. And women were being relegated again kind of to the household and, you know, to these 1950s Gidget kind of personalities. So I was very interested in that. And that was why I started teaching the class, actually. Yeah.
Well, we have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that, and we'll talk with them. And other people who are listening are certainly welcome to join us and share their thoughts. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's someone to talk with in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello. Is our caller there? Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I want to thank you for asking Professor Barron on to talk about this really fascinating and timely subject. And I do have a question.
Sure.
I also am a not-so-secret reader of Chick Lit.
Everybody is.
But something that I cannot ignore is the consumerism and the classism of so many of these novels. Even Barbara Pym, who I absolutely adore, addresses herself very explicitly to the genteel middle-class lady, right?
Yes, she does.
Your example of the Manolo Blahniks is absolutely classic. So I wonder if you could share your thoughts a little bit about the question of social class and perhaps race also in these novels. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. I think that for me as a reader, Chick Lit does two things. And this is the focus of the research that I'm doing and the course that I teach. In some sense, it is a reconfiguration of, I think, a feminist paradigm where women do have sexual power in the bedroom for once. It's the first, I think, genre of literature where you really do see women coming out and talking very openly about their sexual experiences. So you get characters like Samantha in Sex and the City, and she has a tremendous amount of economic, social, and sexual prowess. On the other hand, I think it also reconciles itself to what's now referred to as post-feminism. And the attitude is that we've lost the sexual revolution, and that women are completely disempowered in our culture, and that the right place for them is to have sort of lower-level jobs and to go back and to re-indoctrinate themselves into the home. And that's the part that the caller brought up that really deals with the issue of consumerism, where women are constantly focused on weight and on looksism and on trying to create a perfect mirage of themselves in order to attract the perfect husband. And I think it's a backlash to some extent against feminism. And it's what I object to in the genre. In a sense, it teaches girls a kind of Barbie-esque view of themselves and their bodies, and it re-indoctrinates them to a re-corseting of the female body in terms of dieting and provocative undergarments. And it re-indoctrinates them into the role of the 50s happy homemaker as well. So I think the literature is, it's got almost a schizophrenic kind of a construct in it, where to some extent it's got a you go girl, you know, Spice Girl empowering women. And on the other hand, it very clearly, like, just completely relinquishes power back to men again. And in fact, one of the passages I marked out for today was Bridget has a sexual encounter with Daniel Cleaver, who's the hottie in the novel. And the first thing she writes after he leaves is she's sitting and waiting for him to call. And she says, how can the balance between the sexes be so unbalanced, you know, after women's rights? I'm sitting here, and she says, I feel like I'm waiting to hear whether I passed an exam or not. Hmm. So men still have all the power.
Well, let me, there's another issue here I want to get to, but let me follow up on that, because I think that for the reasons that you have just cited, a lot of women have come down really hard on Chick Lit.
Yeah, and I understand why.
And have essentially said, it's no good. It promotes the wrong kind of thinking. It's a step backwards, saying things like, if you were a feminist, you shouldn't read this. You shouldn't promote it. It's not good. It should be any woman with a brain should boycott this and run as fast as possible the other direction.
Okay. So let me respond to that, because I think the relevance of it for me and the importance of it for women is that it does focus on women as a commodity. And the caller brought up the issue of race, too. Early Chick Lit novels really completely were written about, they had a very Anglo-centric construct in them. Everybody was white. And that's even the case with Sex and the City. I was pretty shocked that it took place in New York and none of the heroines were Jewish even. And so it was very Anglo-Saxon and it was very limited. That's changed now because Chiclet's been around on the market now for 10 plus years and it is much more racially diverse now. There are Chiclet novels about African-American women and in the late 90s there was a Jewish British woman who started writing. And I think that kind of Sue Margolis moved the balance over from just being an Anglo-centric thing to becoming more ethnic. So you get pieces like Bend It Like Beckham, which deals with immigrant literature. And The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, where one of the characters is Latina. So I think it's moving in the right direction. But you're right. Feminists say, yeah, run. You're run in because... it really does advocate, or as I said, a kind of recorseting of women and a movement back into the household. I would say, though, it also functions as a way to explore why this is happening and how women are distraught by this as well. The women in these novels are well aware of the fact that they're failing feminism 101 and that they can't move beyond these kinds of glass ceilings and these barriers that are still in place by men in the culture. And I think the novels create a sense of community for women to discuss this in, you know, a comic setting. But there are very serious issues that the novels bring up. And you're right, some of them are junky. I remember reading one a couple of years ago, Diary of a Mad Mother-to-Be and a Mad Bride. It was awful. It was absolute tripe. But I brought one of the other novels, I think, is just absolutely first-rate, Alison Pearson's I Don't Know How She Does It. And I think it deals with some very serious issues mm-hmm. that women are facing as we've moved into the new millennium.
And just again to what I think is really interesting, and I guess it says something about the power of this genre, is that now there are women writing all of there are Indian women that is in India, Indian women who are writing those books.
Imaginary Man came out about a year and a half ago about an not Native American, but Indian woman in the United States, and
So it's not all. Even though this is maybe where it started, or at least those are the books that we can think of that are a lot of British women writers, and also American mm-hmm. women writers. There are women who are picking up on this genre. So coming out of other cultures, and that I suppose that says something about. This kind of story, this kind of novel really has powerful appeal.
It does. I think women see themselves in these novels. And I think to some extent, despite the fact that there is a lot of focus on consumerism in the novel and on dressing women for success with men in the bedroom, that there are women who are empowered in the boardroom from reading these novels as well.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Iris Barron. She's an instructor in the Department of English at University of Illinois. We're talking a little bit about women in literature, Chick Lit and Beyond. That's the title we put on the show. This is a subject that she concentrates on in her teaching and in her work. And if you have questions, comments, you want to join the conversation, you can certainly call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You said that you have this book here, I Don't Know How She Does It, which you thought was a particularly good book, good writing. You've marked some passages. You want to read a little something?
Yeah. Alison Pearson published this book in about 5 or 6 years ago. And she's another British writer. She had a column like Helen Fielding and transformed it into a novel. And it deals with the main character is this woman, Kate Reddy, who's a broker in the city of London, which is the financial district, like Wall Street. And the passage that I'm reading, she's got an intern who comes from Sri Lanka, and there's tremendous sexism in the firm that they work in. And she tells her, the way I look at it, women in the city are like first-generation immigrants. You get off the boat, you keep your eyes down, you work as hard as you can, and you do your damnedest to ignore the taunts of ignorant natives who hate you just because you look different and you smell different, and because one day you might take their job, and you hope. You know it's probably not going to get that much better in your own lifetime, but just the fact that you occupy the space, the fact that they had to put a Tampax dispenser in the toilet, well, all that makes it easier for the women who come after you. Years ago, when I was at school, I read this book about a cathedral by William Golding. It took several generations to build a medieval cathedral, and the men who drew up the plans knew that not their sons, but their grandsons or even their great-grandsons would be around for the crowning of the spire that they had dreamed of. Well, it's the same for women in the city. I think we are the foundation stones. The females who come after us will scarcely give us a second thought, but they will walk on our bones. Mm-hmm.
Is there, do you have reason to believe that we are talking here about how now there is some diversity in this,
yeah,
in terms of who's doing the writing and who the characters are? But do we also have reason to believe that then those women, say, the now Latina chicklet, is it Latinas that are reading that, or is it the same people who are reading Bridget Jones who are saying, oh, this is cool, it's a little bit different, but it's not. It's me, and yet it's not.
Okay. From my experience in the classroom at the U of I, which is limited to some extent, I do have Latina students who are first-generation Americans and come from, you know, working-class backgrounds who are definitely reading it and seeing themselves in it. African-American students who also, you know, come from the inner city who are reading it and seeing themselves in it. These are really popular novels, and publishers know that they mean big bucks for them. And, you know, I think the great thing about Chick Lit is that it empowers women, and the bad thing about Chick Lit is that they're all incredibly formulaic novels. Every single one has the exact same plot, essentially. And the end shot is that there's always a heterosexual union at the end of the novel, and women always end up with a husband, or in the case of I Don't Know How She Does It, and I'll give a plot spoiler here, so if people don't want to listen, they can plug their ears. Her husband leaves her, the character, because she's working so many hours in the city, and she eventually reconciles with her husband, but she quits her job. And so I find that very disturbing, actually, although to some extent realistic. I think there's a lot of young women, unfortunately, who are moving in the direction of getting degrees and then staying home with their kids and not working. I hear it in the classroom from my students.
Yeah.
A lot of kids getting married at 21 or 22 and saying that they're going to have kids by 24, 25, 26 because they don't want to be older moms and they don't want to work their whole lives and be sort of removed from their kids.
Yeah. You know, you were talking about, you made the point about Bridget Jones, that the structure of the book is that every chapter begins with her weighing,
yeah,
herself, and about the fact that she one of the things she worries a lot about is her weight,
mm-hmm,
and that you can, on the one hand, you can laugh at that, and on the other hand, say, well, you know, actually, I can understand that. I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about how your students talk about that. Now,
okay,
we're of an age where we are old enough so that undergrads could be our kids.
I have a kid who's beyond undergrad.
You have a kid who's beyond undergrad. Okay. So here, this is certainly a generation past the second wave of feminism. I don't know how many waves were.
This is the post-feminist.
The post-feminist. And how it is that particularly those young women think about these same things. And while they, on the one hand, we've told them, this unhealthy preoccupation,
mm-hmm,
with weight and appearance is just a bad thing, and they can laugh at Bridget Jones. But on the other hand, are they too saying, it still matters. It's still really important what you look like. Yes, I still worry about my appearance. Yes, I'm worried about finding a guy. Yes, 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 yes. And who would say that, well, for all we talk about things having changed, maybe things haven't changed very much.
Yeah. Unfortunately, things have not changed very much. And I think the reflective part of Chick Lit is that it examines the fact that things have not changed very much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a movement very much back to a 50s style nuclear family and a stay-at-home mother. I think a lot of the girls that I have in my classes feel torn by this. A lot of them actually have eating disorders, and they're very open about it in the classroom. And a lot of the kids who don't say they focus on it a lot and they work out a lot. And if I go into a class with 36 kids and ask how many of you guys know somebody who's anorexic or bulimic, every single student raises their hand. And if I ask the students how many of you are concerned about your weight and watch your weight, and how many of you who are heterosexual are worried about how guys are going to look at you, every single one of them will raise their hands as well. So I think it is unfortunate. We're still packaging women as a commodity, as a kind of a Barbie doll. And yeah, that is the downside of these novels, because feminist critics feel that it gives voice and validity to creating a view of women as a commodity. And as I said, I've kind of torn as a reader and a critic between them. I think they critique it, but they also support it.
Yeah. Well, that would be my next question, and that is, can you look at this as being a critique of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Or is it in fact? So some people would say it's jump on the wagon and follow the program. And so it maybe does that in part, but it does also. Could be also pointing to the fact that saying, look at this. This really isn't very healthy, is it?
Yeah, well, I think, Fielding really mocks the weight issue in Bridget Jones's diary. There, in the middle of the novel, Bridget gets down to 119 pounds and she records it as a joyous and historic day. And she goes on for three pages about how great it is. And this is her life's goal. Not academic, not intellectual, not career-based, but her life's goal is losing weight. And I met Helen Fielding, actually, in California a few years ago, and I asked her, how tall Bridget was supposed to be. And she said, 5'5 or 5'6. In earlier parts of the novel, Bridget says she's horrified and terrifying, slide into obesity. She weighs 130 pounds at that point. Yeah, I do think Fielding mocks it because her friends tell her that she looks absolutely terrible and to go home and go to sleep. And her best friend Tom calls her up and says, I think you look better the other way, hon. And she says, I feel like a scientist who discovers that, his life's work has been absolutely meaningless. And at the end of the novel, she weighs the most she's weighed in the course of the year. And that's when she gets boyfriend Mark Darcy. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of mocking that goes on.
Let's talk with somebody else here, some other folks listening. Someone on a cell phone in North Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd just like to comment on something that happened within the last month or so. And I don't know the name, but there was a portrait of a young woman that was supposedly a portrait of some novelist. It was being offered for $800,000 at Sotheby's, and nobody put in any bid. And apparently the reason why is people said no one who wrote poetry, I think it was poetry.
Well, I think it was Jane Austen, actually.
Oh, the Jane Austen portrait. I know which one you're talking about. There's a lot of discussion about whether that's actually Austen or not.
But one of the main criticisms was that it couldn't be because she was too attractive to write poetry like that or write novels like that. That completely blew my mind that one had a connection between the way one looked even when they were young and what they could write about. So I was curious about your comment on that.
That's a really interesting point of view that you brought up about this. And actually, in terms of, I'm an Austen specialist, and there has been a lot of controversy about what Austen looked like, because her sister Cassandra drew a portrait of her, and she looks kind of angry in it, actually. And there's a Victorian one where it was redone and she looks all dreamy and sweet. I know the portrait you're talking about now. There's controversy over whether it's a portrait of Austen when she was young or not. Yeah, I think there is a very divided opinion in the public now about whether women can be intelligent and attractive at the same time. And sadly, I think one of the things that these novels assert is that in order to have a successful relationship with a man, that you constantly have to be on guard, with your weight and, on guard with what you wear, and that only the most attractive women can actually you know, maintain a relationship with a husband, and they have to be deferential to men to mm-hmm. some extent. And I think that's why feminists react so strongly mm-hmm. and say, run from these books. But they're all over the bookstores, and they sell, you know, in droves. And Sex and the City was one of the most popular TV shows that was ever on. And, you know, it deals with all of these issues. And I found it very disappointing at the end of the Sex and the City series that all of these women got paired up with a spouse or a potential spouse. And it did sort of support that idea that women should never be alone.
Yeah. I think that one of the audiences for Sex and the City, I'm sure, are young men. Now, they may not admit
it.
They're watching, and they're watching because they're trying to get some clues.
Oh, on how to attract women?
Well, either that or, trying to get some idea about, you know, what's going on inside women's heads and how to understand them and what they want. I'm just wondering if there are guys who are secretly reading chick lit because they're thinking they are also trying to figure out.
Figure out how to mark their territory, as it were. I had a guy in my chick lit class last year who's actually in medical school this year. And he outed himself in the classroom and said that he used to go and rent Sex and the City episodes and pretend that they were for his girlfriend. And I laughed really hard when he said this. So he wasn't trying to attract a girl or even to understand what made his girlfriend's head tick. He loved them.
Oh, he just liked
it. Hilarious and funny, and thought that guys actually had a lot of the same issues. Yeah. But they would never open up on the page the way women do. Although there is Ladlit, which is an offshoot of chick lit.
Nick Horn. Hornby is the one guy that I sort of think of. And I think that there are other male writers who are doing something that seems to exist in a parallel universe
with
what it is we're talking about. So there actually is something like that going on the guy side.
Yeah, there definitely is. It's not attracting as many patrons as the chick lit novels are in the bookstores, that's for sure.
Guys, I like stuff where stuff blows up.
I see that with the guys in my family.
So are most of the students in the courses that you've taught women?
Sadly, yes.
Not a lot of guys signing up?
I usually get like anywhere in the range of 3 to 4 guys is a good show of masculinity in the classroom. So not a lot of guys taking these classes, no. But lots of girls and girls who've read these novels and want sort of, I think, approval for having read them, because they're teased a lot about, oh, you're reading that. We can all walk around, as I said, with our copies of Harry Potter proudly displayed. But God forbid we should be walking around with a pink copy of I Don't Know How She Does It.
Yeah, just put that in a plain brown wrapper.
That's right. And some of the kids do.
Let's talk with the caller in Urbana here, line 2. Hello.
Oh, hi. Mm-hmm. How are you? Yeah. I'm glad I wasn't quite sure where you were at on Sex and the City until you... I think it's sort of an obscenity to women, actually. I think I've seen most of them, but not on cable, you know, in the non-cable version. But I was going to ask you, there's a film that was made in 2005, and I don't know if you discuss films or in your classes or not.
I do.
Called Claire Dolan. You ever heard of it?
I haven't. I taught my Big Fat Greek Wedding last semester.
Yeah, it's about a woman who's a higher-end prostitute in New York,
mm-hmm.
and... I would highly recommend you, the Urbana Library has a copy of it, and watch it. It is it's a brilliant film about how the male world looks at women. I was just amazed when I saw this film that it was actually made and actually sent out. It's purely from her perspective. And one of the things when you talk about Sex and the City, you know, of course it was based on a book, the euphemism, and, you know, a film... And then written mostly by Darren Star, I think, the producer. Of course, then whenever I see stuff like this, I say, oh, gee, let's see if it's really from a woman's perspective. But, of course, it's always from a man's perspective. And I agree with it, the fact that you'd have very few men in your classes because they don't want to know.
Maybe.
They would rather just, there's the whole mythos and mythology that's perpetuated. And you were talking about the women in your class all having problems with friends that have anorexia, and the media. I used to own a marketing company years ago, and I sold it. And I used to do a lot of advertising for the motorsports industry. And so I knew a lot of people in the business. And it basically, I mean, if you were to sit in any of these conferences, you would just, you wouldn't be able to eat for a week. I mean, it's amazing what these people, their mindsets of these business people. But I don't know. I just really appreciate your work. But it's just fascinating to me how this stuff is, it could have an original intent to, for like, say, women writing about women and saying, aren't we being manipulated and, whatever terms you,
exactly,
you want to use. But how when marketing gets a hold of it, they flip it and it becomes the thing to do.
Pink think.
And if you, I would highly suggest you try to get a copy of this film. It's so wonderfully done. It's actually unbelievably depressing because it's so relentlessly correct.
And there is a perspective, and I think rightly so, that to some extent that Chick Lit endorses a kind of prostituting of the female body and the female psyche.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it's accidental that people have come up with these viewpoints about it.
It's, well, you know, you can go back to biology, too, and, or, you know, the attraction sector of life, you know, attract a spouse, mate, whatever. But it's just a cultural thing, and it's just amazing. And I just thought I'd recommend that to you because I've recommended it to some people. And ironically, all the women that I know have asked, why don't you watch this film? They tell me I didn't like it at all. And I go, well, I understand why. But, I mean, it's really a relentlessly brutal film about the idea of how, I mean, it's just a really fascinating movie. I'm surprised. It was written by a woman and directed by a woman, which, of course, gives it a good perspective. So it's an independent film. So thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for recommending that.
Okay, let's go on. Kinkakee is next. Line number four. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I'm really enjoying this. As I'm driving down the road here, lots and lots of topics are coming up. First of all, would you consider Zadie Smith's work part of this genre?
No, I would say Zadie Smith more reflects kind of a restructuring of really more traditional literature, Howard's End, you know. But I think it's hard to draw lines around all of this stuff. They certainly begin to converge in pieces, so you're not entirely wrong about that.
Okay. Male authors that may be doing the same thing on the other side of the gender line, I'm thinking Jonathan Lethem would probably be appropriate for this category. He's written Motherless Brooklyn.
I'm seeing a lot more, quote, what the Brits refer to as lad lit, and I kind of think it started with Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim, and you see it being perpetuated by a lot of male authors now. And I think also guys realized women were making a lot of money on this. And, you know, why be cut out of a major media and economic event for themselves? So, but I think it's interesting because I think it kind of denudes the male psyche in the same way that Chick Lit did that. So I'm starting to read a lot more lad lit now, too. And I find it really fascinating and enjoyable.
And lastly, it's a bit off topic, but we were talking about how people were drawn into the Jane Austen revival.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of the Patrick O'Brien series of novels. And O'Brien outwardly would seem to be not in this at all, since he writes novels of 19th century Royal Navy affairs. But
I haven't read them, but I know which novels you're talking about.
The sensibility of his novels is firmly rooted in Austen's whole viewpoint. Everything that he's written in this series is of a person living in that age, and he himself cites Austen, if not as source material, certainly as inspirational for the whole series. So anyway. Patrick O'Brien brought me to Jane Austen. Thank goodness.
Okay.
I'm really enjoying this.
I think the difference between Austen and the Chick Lit writers is that Austen was living in a period of time where women virtually had no rights. They were literally their father's property, and when they married, they were their husband's property. And I think what Austen does so beautifully in Pride and Prejudice is she creates this gutsy heroine, Elizabeth Bennet, and yeah, she's upper middle class, and she's white, and she's Anglo-Saxon, but she refuses to take any guff from men, particularly hot but remote and nasty and snobby Mr. Darcy, who my students find so delicious. And I find I'm very drawn to him as a character as well. And what she does with, she gives Elizabeth a certifiable feminist voice, and she refuses to auction herself off in the novel to the highest bidder. And I think what happens in Chick Lit is that women took the formula of what Jane Austen was doing, and they spun it in a kind of 90s and now new millennial context. But I find it disturbing that these women, in fact, are very willing, including Bridget Jones herself, to auction themselves off to the highest bidder. That's what, you know, the be-all and end-all of the novels are about. And I think it's a cultural affirmation of this imperative that all women are worthless unless they're married and they become mothers. And the new Chick Lit, maybe we can talk about it another time, is moving toward women embracing maternity. I just finished reading last night Shopaholic and Baby, which is the last of the Confessions of a Shopaholic series. And all these novels now have moved in the direction of maternity. And the Chick Lit just keeps widening its audience base. Kids now, Chick Lit novels for kids. The Princess Diaries was the first one. There's more and more. And now for more mature women, I won't use older women, like myself.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have one caller we can't take. But that does get it with the last question I was thinking with. Is this trend peaked at all? And it sounds like
I don't think so yet. I'm hoping to get a whole lot of academic mileage on this before it does. But I think it hasn't. It's attracting, if anything, a wider and wider base. Christian Chick Lit, Jewish Chick Lit, Muslim Chick Lit, lesbian and gay Chick Lit. It's just moving out in an ever-widening concentric circle. So there's something in it that draws readers to it. And I think it's an affirmation of the kinds of cultural issues that women have to face in the new millennium.
Well, there we will stop with our thanks to our guest, Iris Barron. She's instructor in the Department of English at University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for asking me.